When Jesus walked the earth, he restored and healed the lives of people, most of whom were not even aware of who he was or understood the fullness of his message. They simply received his mercy and were forever changed by his love. He came bringing literal good news, and we are invited to continue in his mission to love the unlovely, touch the untouchable, heal the sick, and set the captives free. As followers of Christ and workers in the field of sexual health, it is not our task to be fence builders, dividing who is in and who is out, but rather well diggers, that all may drink the living water and never thirst again.
You're going to find that the term STI and STD are kind of interchangeably used. If you go on to the MMWR site, which is the Bible of STD testing, so you do want to go to that site, you can download an entire digital manual that is all about STDs, all about the protocol that is from the CDC. So that's the MMWR, and you want the guidelines that were released from the 2015, but digitally just download that so you have those for your records. And then what we did is we just put dividers in there for each of the different diseases, because that gives you most of the information. There are also then updates that you can get from the CDC so that when things change, you are alerted to what those changes are. So, for example, a few months ago, you wouldn't have thought of the Zika virus being anything to do with sexually transmitted. Well, now we have to be more alert, asking questions of our clients. Have they traveled out of the country? Has any of their other, partners traveled out? And some of that information when we're doing. So it's always important. And that's another thing I want to say as far as the digital download that you'll get. What we are sending out today, it could be that before you even receive it, that there is new changed material. So you have to keep up with what your medical director's directives are. I know for our medical director, because he is so busy, often when we see the alert first, we're taking a change in the protocol. When it went to where Cipro was found to be resistant and not treating gonorrhea, that really changed the focus with us, because then we had to go to the shot of Rocephin. And we'll get into that a little bit more in detail, but it's often us that are going to the medical director, letting him know. But just with the MMWR, that is a digital download that gives you good information. And you'll see that sometimes people will interchangeably use STD and STI. There is a little bit of a differentiation in definitions. And one is a sexually transmitted infection can be screened for, but you may not necessarily have the disease. So, for example, you might screen someone, you might test someone for HIV, but they don't have the disease of AIDS. You may screen someone, they may have the antibodies for herpes, but they don't necessarily have the physical manifestations of the disease of herpes. So that's where the differentiation is between STD and STI. But a lot of times those are used intermittently and interchangeably. I think one of the things that we have to start on is always knowing what the determination and the definitions are. Before we jump into this a little bit further, I just want to make a couple comments so that contextually maybe that will help in your framework as far as how you approach adding the STI services. There are many opportunities in your community to find out what is being done. And I think we're in an interesting season in our healthcare in America, depending on which administration goes into the next era, what that may look like, whether Obamacare continues, whether or not we have more private physicians because of the payback from Medicaid, et cetera, that may be stepping out. We're going to have to find creative ways that we may have to look at how we are jumping in and how we are serving. When we very first started looking at the STI service issue in our community, we started with the Missouri Department of Health. Most all of us in our communities have a health department that is providing some sector of STI testing. Now, I think one of the things that we want to consider is, are they doing it from the same holistic process that we are? Are they providing the emotional and the physical and the spiritual aspect of it? And a lot of them are providing the physical. They are providing some of the testing, but they're not providing some of the other services. But they can be an excellent resource. So the first time that we went to our city health department, they were not interested in partnering. They were not interested in playing ball with us. We then went to the county and asked the county about, you know, we did not want to duplicate services, but we realized we were engaging a demographic that was not going to the free health clubs or the free health departments, and were looking for another resource. And so that was an opportunity that we could offer. We started looking at the health departments and realized that in our area, health departments were not being served with an on-site physician. So how was it that they were testing, they were treating, but there was not a physician on site? And we realized that when there is a public health safety arena, when we have our health departments that are administering some of the immunizations, there is typically not a physician that is on site, but they are under standing orders able to provide those services. So in the state of Missouri, and every state is going to be significantly different, but in the state of Missouri, we actually had a partnership and have an ongoing partnership where we are a collection site, and they recognize that if you're collecting, you're going to get positives, and so they provide treatment to us to then dispense as a public health investment in the community. The program under which we are doing the gonorrhea and chlamydia is actually called the Infertility Prevention Program. Not everyone is able to jump into that program. Sometimes there are very strict limitations. We had to make sure that we were signing a document. We had to make sure that we were clarifying up front that we were not providing birth control and we were not providing condoms, that we were making sure that they knew that the scope of services under which we provided were very limited, that we were there for a sexual health crisis. They saw no problem with that. Now, I will tell you that once a year when they come, they will bring a carload of the newest flavors and colors of condoms, and we usually have to remind them that, oh, that is not in alignment with what we're doing. And they're like, oh yeah, we forgot. That's your place. There are plenty of places where people can get those supplies. They're not going to get it from, you know, that misalignment with what we're doing. But that's how we operate, is under standing orders, and all of the standing orders under which we operate are in your digital download that you will get. A lot of times that's where a lot of your medical physicians, your medical directors, they don't have time to do the research on what all of those standing orders are. So to be able to go with them and say, hey, these are the parameters under which we're looking, and these are the standing orders under which we're serving. Now, Sandy, you might be able to weigh into that more than, and I know that Dr. Nicole was just saying that it's going to depend on which state you're in, whether or not they will allow standing orders. We also have nurse practitioners that have a collaborative practice with the physician that also will come down and do some of our pelvics and paps. But it really is going to be up to you to look at your particular state and to know whether or not they will allow you to do standing orders and to offer treatment. But with the Missouri Department of Health, what they do is they actually provide the kits for gonorrhea and chlamydia. We'll talk a little bit more about that, HIV and syphilis, and then they provide the treatment. Now, for HIV, we actually partner with another organization and refer, because we just don't have the capacity to be able to provide the care, because it is such an involved process. But we have on site the treatment for gonorrhea, for chlamydia, and for syphilis. And then we partner with another lab company that already prepackages all of our dosage for treatment of BV and trichomonas with metronidazole. One of the things you'll find in the arena of STDs, there really are not that many antibiotics. It's a very small sector of antibiotics that you're using to do any kind of treatment. I've been there 13 years and never seen an interaction that resulted in any kind of patient crisis, but that's where you have to do the very intentional screening to know if there's any adverse reactions, if there's any allergies. So, much like you would be in a physician's office, you have to make sure that you're doing that careful assessment. As we're moving through, I'm going to ask that Sandy and Nicole, if they want to speak into it as physicians, to please feel that freedom to add. There is always new tests and new processes that are out there that I want them to be able to speak into. As I mentioned, one of the important things is that we are defining for our clients, for our students, what we're talking about when we're doing medically accurate information. And so, even as we're looking at the definition of sex, sex is defined as bodily contact meant to give or gain sexual gratification. And so in our classrooms, we say that anything from your head to your toe, your hands, your mouth, anyone involved in the underwear zone that is gaining pleasure from another, that is considered sex. So that means oral sex, anal sex, mutual masturbation, vaginal sex. Those are all definitions of what sex is. I think a lot of times people will think, oh, well, it's not vaginal, so it's not really sex. Well, as you'll see in the presentation, if you can get a sexually transmitted infection, that is because it is sexually transmitted. So we're going to talk about what that looks like. One of the important things to understand is that a lot of our clients truly believe, oh, it's just us, right? So if he's taken a shower and he's good, then it's all good, because I just know by looking at him that he couldn't possibly have a sexually transmitted infection. We found at one point in time several years ago that fifth and sixth graders were having shower parties, and we were trying to figure out what a shower party was. Well, literally, when mom and dad were gone, they would have a slumber party, they would jump into a shower, and they would have sex with multiple partners, and it was being considered as clean. They couldn't possibly get an STD if they were in the shower. The other thing that was precipitating was that they, at that point in time, were having rainbow parties. And so girls would put on different color lipsticks, and whoever could give oral sex the highest and make their mark, that was the queen of the night. So, I'm going to tell you that this portion of what we're talking about does have some definite degradation, and I don't want you to leave with your mind filled with all the evil that is out there, but I think it's important for us to be aware and to be educated. Some of the things that the children are exposed to through pornography and through what parents are watching or what partners of parents are watching is exposing young minds to a lot. And so I think it's very important for us to be able to educate. And so one of the things that we've really worked with those that come into our client rooms, it's not a scare tactic, but it is very important to know that if your partner has ever had another partner who might have had another partner, or you've had another partner, that whole history comes into your relationship, and it can, bottom line, expose you to many more. So we believe that education is empowerment, and that we want to not limit the education, but really provide a lot of information. We know that youth disproportionately share a lot of the STIs. Americans aged 15 to 24 make up just 27% of the sexually active population, and yet they account for 20% of the 20 million new STIs that are every year. If you look at young people that account for a substantial amount of the STIs, 70% of gonorrhea are in this particular age bracket. You can see sort of the red or the hot pink correlating with the different ages. 49% of HPV infections, 26% of HIV are in this particular sector, chlamydia, herpes, and then the syphilis. So in Missouri alone in 2013, we had 27,000 cases of chlamydia, and most of those were in that age bracket of the 15 to 24. Gonorrhea and chlamydia are two of the three sexually transmitted infections that are seen to lead to PID. We're going to talk a little bit about bacterial vaginosis. It is not considered a sexually transmitted infection. However, you're going to see that it is listed in the MMWR under that section, and most of those that are not having sex don't have that BV, but we're going to talk a little bit about the correlation between those. I think if you look at sort of the astounding data, it shows that in the youth demographic, that there's a huge difference between what is actually reported and what is actually guesstimated as being out there. So many people, because it doesn't always have symptoms, don't go for testing or do not even realize. So if you look at 200,000 cases, but this is how much they're guesstimating gonorrhea is in our nation. If you look at chlamydia, 1 million cases reported, but 1.8 that are estimated as new infections. So there's a real disconnect between those. We're going to look at three different sectors of STIs, bacterial, viral, and parasitic. Bacterial basically means that there is a treatment, there is a cure. Viral, I would say that it used to be that we would think that there is no cure. But now looking at some of the stuff that's coming out with Hep C, they're kind of waffling on that. So there's some new information that's pretty phenomenal about how they're treating the Hep C. And then parasitic, basically that's pretty descriptive. It is curable, and there are antibiotics that can treat that. We're going to start with chlamydia because I think that's one of the most prevalent reportable that does involve and does affect our clients. It's known as a silent disease, as I said, and the undiagnosed prevalence rate is appalling. Approximately 1 in 80 are all that are diagnosed. Many others don't know that they even have it. Some interesting names that it often goes by on the street is gooey stuff, the clam, rooster crow, grapefruit, snow pie, and I'm not sure where all of these came from. I just know from our research that that is some of the things that it is commonly known as. The most frequently reported bacteria in STI in the USA, as far as the bacterial, this is chlamydia. The estimated age is that 1 in 15 sexually active females aged 14 to 18 has chlamydia. We've seen that in, you know, nationally they'll say 1 in 4 teens has a positive, 1 in 4 sexually active teens will test positive for a sexually transmitted infection. What we see is 1 in 3, and it's not because there's a lot more sex going on in Missouri. It's because the education in the schools is such that we have a lot more people coming. And obviously, those that are coming for sexual health services. Transmission for chlamydia is anal, oral, vaginal sex, or in some cases, it is a mother-to-child transmission. Symptoms, if there are any, can include discharge, burning with urination, pain, and abnormal bleeding. Sometimes people will complain of pain during intercourse. So those are some of the things that may occur predominantly in a female. If you'll look for just a second at these two visual pictures of the cervix, tell me just, you know, what are the differences between the two that you see? Can you visualize as far as which is more of your mature and which is your younger? And does it make any kind of a difference? If you look at this one over here, this is of a much younger cervix. And so the cell configuration that is on a more mature cervix does have a bit of a tougher skin, for lack of a more medical term. But if you look at the young one, it's almost like a sponge. So the receptivity to an STI in that younger cervix is of greater consequence than it is with an older. The cervix itself is not considered fully mature until someone is the age of 25. So if you have a 12-year-old that is engaging in sex, or a 14-year-old, or a 15-year-old, you know, their chances of kind of absorbing a disease infection can be much higher, and thus we see the prevalence so much greater. So I think those are some important things when we're doing our education, is to understand that the younger you are, the more susceptible that you may be. The progression to pelvic inflammatory disease, I think this is very important for us to understand. And basically we know that anytime there is an infection, the cervix is often the place where it's most infected, and then it can actually travel up into the tubes, and that's where you lead to some of that infection staying in there and leads to the progression of the infection. And then once it does get into the whole pelvic area, that's when it can be life-threatening to an individual. And so you can end up, even if it is treated, sometimes it cannot reverse some of the damage. My understanding is that if you have had 4 cases of chlamydia and they have been untreated, that those 4 cases are likely to impact whether or not you may be able to have children because of the scar tissue. Now, I think we have to be very careful that we're not saying that everyone who has an infertility issue has had chlamydia, because that is not a relatable comment. So we have to be very careful in how we're transferring some of that information. But it is very, very important that we understand that chlamydia and gonorrhea are known as the sort of the predetermining factors that often lead to bacteria or to pelvic inflammatory disease, as well as the bacterial vaginosis. There can be residual results from PID that can lead to chronic pelvic pain that may not go away even with the treatment of antibiotics. Use that. But you can see very definitely how, if there is a surgical procedure where there is any kind of a forcing of instruments into the cervix, and it is not done, and it is done under conditions where there is already an active STI, that penetration of the disease can be more of a complicating factor. So that's one of the things that we want to make sure that we're looking for. Again, the understanding of the sort of the cilii that is destroyed whenever that disease, with all of the infection that accumulates in the tubes, is what often leads to the long-term effects and the adhesions of where it's kind of scarring together. So that does put women at a risk. The area of infection in men is usually the inside of the urethra. Symptoms are a little bit more easily detected. You know, I think the internal vault system that we as females have, often we can't see what's going on in there, or we can't distinguish between what is normal discharge and what is abnormal discharge. But chlamydia in a male usually results in more painful indications and often will bring them in much faster than it will a female. The screening options, there is a very, very simple process for screening for chlamydia these days, and it is through urine. And that is simply what we do, is we offer, they can opt in or they can opt out for the screening. We don't force anyone to participate, but they give us written permission that they do want the gonorrhea and chlamydia. Gonorrhea and chlamydia is often screened concurrently in one process, and it is done through a very sensitive, very specific. In fact, my understanding is that the sensitivity of the testing for the urine is almost better than the endocervical swab, and certainly better than the urethral. And so, you know, I think that's something to take into consideration, that it is also so much less invasive for a young woman if she doesn't have any other symptoms, or if we're just wanting to get them screened. It's a step to getting their gynecological care started. And obviously with a man, it is so much easier for a man to give a urine sample than to have a urethral swab. When I started doing the STI screening 13 years ago, that's how we swabbed men that came into our clinic setting, was with a urethral swab. And it was very uncomfortable for them, and it was uncomfortable for me. So now being able to do the urine test is so much less invasive. You do want to follow good protocol. You want to make sure that when you know they're coming in for a screening, that you ask them not to have voided, not to have emptied their bladder, not to have urinated for at least 1 hour before collecting the specimen, because that does allow a more accurate reading of that urine collection. You can do the endocervical, you can do the urethral, you can do the rectal, and you can do the pharyngeal. Now, an endocervical is going to be recommended, but it's not part of a routine PAP. So that's something to keep into consideration if somebody says, oh, I don't need that, I had a PAP. I think we mentioned that earlier. So you do want to still collect the urine testing if you're screening, even if they tell you they've had a PAP. One of the things that I think it's important to understand is, in a demographic, if you are opening up to test any individuals in your community, if anal sex is the only receptive site of sex, then an anal swab is going to be what's indicated. If oral sex is the only receptive, then a pharyngeal swab is it is what is most highly recommended because that's the entry point. But for most of our clients, it's going to be that vaginal introduction and doing the urine test is what's going to be the most accurate to get that information. Treatment is honestly very, very simple for chlamydia. Azithromycin, 1 gram. Single oral dose, one time only. It used to be that you had to stir it up and you had to give it in a drink and it was putrid and I would have people gagging on it, but now it's 4 tablets. At least that's how it's dispensed to us. We do give information that it can cause some tummy upset, it can cause some diarrhea, but that is the preferred method. You can also give doxycycline 100 milligrams orally twice a day for 7 days if someone has any kind of contraindications to taking azithromycin. Really, the CDC does recommend that the azithromycin is better, mainly because of compliance. And so in our particular setting, we are asking them to actually take the azithromycin in our presence. That way we know they haven't taken 2 and then give 2 to their partner when they get home because they want him to be treated too. We do not do expedited partner treatment. That is sometimes recommended, but what we're seeing in our demographic is the education does not translate. And we want that opportunity, not just for good physical education, but we want that opportunity to be able to educate with the spiritual implications as well. So we require that the male partner and or the female partner, depending on how it translates, they come in so we can do the actual visit with them. They can get the same education. One of my colleagues that worked in the abstinence portion of our organization, you know, she just said, hey, you know, if we can get one of the men to come in, and this is a little bit crude, but since there are no men in our room, she said, you know, you get one bull, you're going to get those 5 heifers. So, you know, if we have that opportunity to do the education, a lot of time it's just that a gentleman has not been given the proper education to understand that he may be infecting others. I think that's another thing when it comes to treating those that have gone in for an abortion. We often know that abortion clinics, they'll give azithromycin. They may give metronidazole as sort of a presumptive treatment, but what they haven't done is they haven't done the education. So you've got a young woman that she thinks she's been treated, she's had the surgical procedure, but she's not completely healed, and she goes back to a partner who just reinfects. And then you've got this breeding ground where she's had this procedure, and she's reinfected very quickly, and that puts her at great risk. So I think it's really important that we're doing that educational piece. So doxycycline is a little bit more expensive now. It didn't used to be that way, but azithromycin is sometimes even found on a $4 formulary. So if you are in a situation where you are not going to be providing the treatment on site, you will want to make sure that you have a good arrangement to either notify your medical director so their office can call in a prescription, or your operating understanding orders to where you can call in the prescription so that you make sure the follow through. Because honestly, there's not a whole lot of point to screen them if you're not going to treat them, because then the liability on you for not giving them that gold standard of care really falls on you because you haven't followed through. So we want to make sure that we're getting all that information. Chlamydia is one of those reportable diseases, and so if you are working in the area of doing STI testing, you will need to know what diseases you do have to report, what are mandated as far as giving information, and how that process of partner treatment. There is so much chlamydia right now that they're really not worried about us giving partner information. Now, gonorrhea, syphilis, HIV, they are on that. Like, if you can't track down the partners, they will track down the partners. But with chlamydia, there's so much of it that they're not really even worried about getting somebody treated, because I think they assume that there's so many people that do have it. In pregnant women, untreated chlamydia can lead to premature birth. It can lead to some complications, and it can be transmitted through labor and delivery to a child, and they can get chlamydia of the eyes. So that is something that we want to make sure that most in all OB situations, gonorrhea, chlamydia, HIV, Hep B, and what did I miss there, Sandy? HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and Hep B are all pretty much screened as part of your OB panel so that they know that this is not going to be passed on to a child. But we'll talk a little bit more about how sometimes if they've had multiple partners during the pregnancy, there can be re-exposure and how that can be detrimental. Gonorrhea, has anybody ever heard why gonorrhea is called the clap? Anybody know the story behind that? Actually, it is a very painful disease that, especially in male clients, especially back in the day of war, the only way that they could help someone who was in dire pain was to have their best friends come alongside, one friend hold one hand, one friend hold the other hand, and they would take a board and they would clap the penis between the boards in order to unclog and shoot out the urine because it would stop up, it would clog up. So that's where the term the clap originated from, was because it is very painful. It is sometimes also called the Tuesday disease because typically if you've had sex over the weekend, by Tuesday, you've got extremely painful symptoms. When somebody comes in and they're complaining about painful symptoms, and this is predominantly male, we often automatically wonder about gonorrhea and can be presumptive. Now, the PCR tests that are run for those, they actually will get the results back pretty quick. So we're careful that we don't want to treat too presumptively if we have the opportunity to wait. But if someone is coming in with dire symptoms, we are going to be pretty proactive with gonorrhea and chlamydia to make sure that they're not walking around. The other thing is they come in and then they disappear and they've never gotten the treatment. So we do have to be pretty proactive with a lot of our clients. It's known as the clap, the drip, clapper dose, just several different street names that goes by. Again, there may be no symptoms, but there can be very painful symptoms. If there are symptoms, it may be burning with urination, discharge, vaginal bleeding between periods for women, and sometimes bleeding when they're actually having sex. The transmission can be oral, anal, vaginal sex, or again, it can be one of those that is transferred across childbirth from a mother to a child. The cervix that you see on the top over here, that is considered a healthy cervix. If you look at the one down here, you can see that the os of the cervix is filled with this mucopurulent or this pussy discharge. The term that is often used for the cervix that is in this kind of a situation, it's called friable. And literally, if you barely touch it as you're doing a swab, it can often bleed. And so, that's one of the things that it's so important when we're educating young women is, if we're just doing the pee in the cup method, there is no way that a woman can know what her cervix looks like. So it is important that we're making sure that they're established in good care if they're sexually active, whether or not you're able to provide a pelvic exam for them, or whether or not they see a pediatrician, or whether or not they see their general practitioner. But we want to make sure that they understand that because we as women cannot see our cervix, we do not know what state that cervix may be in. So it's important to educate again that they have that information. Again, in men, it can be so painful that, they do have a drip, they have an ooze, they have almost like a clogging of the urethra, and that can back up into their system to lead to very complicating, significant issues. Now, both chlamydia and gonorrhea can lead to infertility in men, but it's rare. It's more typical that it can lead to inflammation in a woman. There can be epididymitis in men, which is, the infection of the epididymitis because of the result of some of the diseases that are backed up. But there is a higher prevalence, and no one can really say why, but there is a higher prevalence of gonorrhea in the African American population, and there's really not a lot of understanding if that has to do with just the lack of treatment, but that is something to be aware of. Again, it can often be done at the same time that you're doing and drawing up for the chlamydia. It's in the same tube. So we actually just draw up the urine. We put it into a very simple tube. There's already solution in it. It tells you exactly where to fill it up on the line. It is the simplest of procedures. And you will have a standing order, and you'll also have the policy and procedure for the collection of that urine sample. But we just pull it in that. We put it in a biohazard. You can mail it or you can send it to the lab. They process it. They get you back the results. Again, urine, endocervical, urethral, rectal, and the pharyngeal are the sites in which you can have that. It is a very complicated disease in that it has become very resistant to many of the drugs that are out there. Like I said, when I started, it used to be a one-dose, one-pill Cipro, and it was done. There is so much now resistance to Cipro with some of the superbug stuff that's coming out that you have to now give a Rocephin injection, and it is not a, it is a painful injection. So we give it in conjunction with lidocaine. It's a one-time injection. We do also, as recommended by the CDC, you give azithromycin. Now, it used to be thought that, well, gonorrhea could mask the symptoms of chlamydia, so you were dual treating. But actually what they found now is that the zithromycin in conjunction with the Rocephin is the only way that you're truly knocking it out. So it's a combination of both that you have to give together. There are some two-step alternative medications that are out there that you can give. It is extremely expensive for some of those alternative. But if someone has any kind of a reaction to penicillin, et cetera, you need to go that route. For those that are hesitant about doing treatment in your clinic, this may be something where you partner with a physician to basically say, we've got a positive. That person can come in to you. You can tell them that they've got a positive, and then you give them a voucher or a coupon so that they can go to your medical director's office where they will then administer the Rocephin injection for on behalf of your clinic. So a lot of times you have to have some creativity to figure out how you're going to get them treated. One of the things that we've kind of seen is that a lot of times they'll come in for the screening, but they won't come back for the treatment. Or you've got a 15-year-old who can only get the ride once. She's not going to go someplace else because she's fearful. She doesn't want to go to her own pediatrician, or she doesn't want to go to a family because of confidentiality, even though the sexual reproductive health laws pretty much federally will protect her from getting care. There's still this, well, what if she tells my mom, or what if my sister comes in? So we are seeing the importance of getting them treated. Now, is it my desire to treat somebody else's 14-year-old daughter for gonorrhea without the parent being involved? I have to tell you, that's a tough one. But if I know that maybe that mother is not a safe adult, or maybe there's a boyfriend, you know, obviously we are mandatory reporters. So if you've got a 14-year-old that is having sex with someone in that, and every state is a little bit different, or like recently we had a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old. They both were positive for chlamydia, females. They came in. We told them about the importance of bringing partners. They showed up with a 28-year-old male. And what he was doing is he was taking them to parties. He was supplying them with alcohol. It was a case of sex trafficking. But we had not been aware of that at the time, knowing that he was literally pimping them out and using them for himself. So in those cases, you have to make that mandatory report. Now, in this particular case, there was some escalation of their anger towards us, and we actually had the 15-year-old that was very threatening to our staff because we had turned her in, even though they're anonymous, but she knew that no one else knew but us. And the 28-year-old turned out had been a convicted felon, and so even his threats to us. So know that when you're going into this field, we are protecting the voiceless. We are protecting those that don't even realize that they're victims. They don't see themselves as a victim, but that's where those mandatory reporting laws are so important, because we are there to protect the children of the future. So just know that there are some complicating factors that we do have to consider as we're looking at some of this information. What we do is we make sure that with any administration of azithromycin or with the Rocephin, that we always have packets of crackers. So we're always getting something on their tummy so that they don't automatically get nauseated, especially for the treatment of a pregnant woman that comes in. Maybe she doesn't have her Medicaid. Maybe she hasn't been established with OB yet, OB care, but you know that she's got a positive test now. She's 16-year-old. She's pregnant. She's got chlamydia. You know, her Medicaid's not going to kick in for 30 days. How do we make sure that she's protected? Well, we want to make sure that she's got something on her tummy. We want to make sure that we've got her approval, that we can share those records with her OB so that her OB knows, and that she can be retested in 3 months, because that's so important. They will do that. Now, with the gonorrhea, the retest is going to be 3 months that's recommended, but at times they'll come back even in a week to make sure that there's not a resistant form. There is now a new superbug of gonorrhea that has got the CDC pretty worried because they're wondering if it will be even resistant to the Rocephin. So that's really important that we're up to speed on knowing what can and what can't be done. Syphilis, you know, we really thought in the USA that syphilis was going to be eradicated, but then there was a sudden upswing, and in Missouri, it was traced to being brought in by the World Series in St. Louis because of the bathhouses. So it's interesting, but STIs often follow major demographics. I don't know how many of you read the statistics on how many condoms were passed out at the Olympics this year. Staggering. It was almost like they were expecting that someone was going to have sex six times a day with the amount of condoms that were pumped in for that sporting event and for that series. So, you know, trends and what happens in our culture often feeds into the sexual escalation of diseases. But with syphilis, where it was once thought that it was eradicated, there has been an upsurge. You know, it's interesting, but syphilis is probably one of the oldest known sexually transmitted infections. And historians have said that Al Capone, that Hitler, and maybe even Julius Caesar all had the disease of syphilis. The CDC reported that there were just under 50,000 cases in 2013, and Missouri did have a case that was related to infant mortality, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But there are three major stages, but you have the primary stage, you have the secondary, the latent, and you have the late. The transmission is direct contact with the chancre or through pregnancy. I think it's important to understand that with primary, they often will have a chancre and it is not painful. So that kind of distinguishes between a herpatic or someone that may feel that they have a cold sore. It is often round. It is just a sore. It's kind of can be a little bit stiff. In fact, let's just look at this image here. And this distinguishing thing is that it is not painful. So that chancre is something that you look for. And then you also have to understand that usually in about 3 to 6 weeks, it disappears. There's no other symptoms. That's it. So people don't even think, oh, I just had a hair follicle that was infected. You know, they may not understand that there's any issue there. Secondary, they can have a non-itchy rash. Sometimes it can be on the palms of their hand. They can have a sore throat. They can have lymph gland swelling. They can have loss of hair, but not always. And again, they can have lesions 3 to 6 weeks. Latent, all the symptoms disappear. It's as though it's never even happened. And then, of course, late, not everyone is going to have syphilis will go to that stage, but it can happen, and that's if no treatment has happened. So sometimes we'll see a late case of syphilis where there was no treatment, and it may be someone who got through the military or someone. We've seen several cases where, and I know this is hard for some of us to imagine, but some of our clientele comes from our retirement homes. And so they're having sex with others in the retirement home. The advent of the little blue pill and erectile dysfunction has allowed those activities to go on longer than usual and to facilitate healthy lifestyles in some aspects, but it also has been one of those things where we've seen an upsurge of HIV in retirement homes. But when they've come in, we've had a couple late cases of syphilis where it just had gone untreated. And so there is a treatment process for that allows that to be treated. We had an incident where a young man came in complaining of a sore throat, and I had a primary care physician that was visiting with us and helping in our clinic, and she looked in his throat, and, you know, she had been in practice for many years, but she thought, well, maybe possibly this was a case of herpes. Did the testing. It was primary syphilis, and he had these mucopurulent patches that were all down his throat. So we had to get him back in immediately. And I'll tell you, the health department, when it is a syphilis case, they are on it. Like, they almost beat the mail to let you know that there's a case. But they come in. We invite them to come into our facility to help with results like that because we want to make sure that tracking down and tracing. This young man took out his phone and we ask him about partners and the importance of letting us know. He had used an app, and I think in his case it was Adam to Adam, but there's several different apps out there. One's Adam to Adam, one's Grindr, and these apps literally will let you input your information as to what type of sexual activity you will give or you will receive, and that it emits a signal for a 50-mile radius or whatever radius you want to put in, and anyone else that is interested in receiving or participating knows exactly where to locate you. So you don't exchange names or numbers or anything like that at that point. You just merely hook up in the third stall at the movie theater or the west wing of the mall, and you participate in this activity. He had 15. Now, in this case, he had managed to get the phone numbers, but he had 15 partners. Didn't know their name, but he knew everybody by a phone number that then had to be contacted and had to be treated. One of our cases that we had earlier this year was the Missouri Department of Health. They really, really like us. And so when they have a case, they often will refer them to us because they know that we're going to go the extra mile with compassion and with love. And so they had told this young woman that she had to come down for treatment with us. And in this particular case, she was actually a prostitute that was going from truck stop to truck stop, prostituting herself in exchange for meth or coke or heroin, whatever she could get. But she had come in contact with an individual. He listed her as a partner, but this particular individual had neuroocular syphilis, caused blindness in one eye, and it was going to the second eye when they realized that it was syphilis. And so we're giving him the treatment for that. So they had sent her to us for presumptive treatment because of her exposure. But that was, I think, the case that we realized how important it was for us to be asking questions and to going deeper in getting information. Because in essence, she was a trafficked victim that was being used. Even though she was of age, the person that was using her to get the drugs for that profit, and that was a hard, hard case. The treatment for syphilis is not very kind. I mean, it is a very painful. As you can see from this particular picture, the chancre is highly, highly infective. And so any skin-to-skin contact. Now, just note, this is above the pubic hairline. So tell me that a condom is going to prevent the spread of this chancre. Absolutely not. Unless they come out with a body condom, this particular chancre is going to infect someone else. If you look at the chancre that this gentleman has on his lip, this is not a cold sore. This is a chancre. Again, any type of oral practice, oral services in that way, this can give syphilis and transmit syphilis in that particular manner. Women who are pregnant are at very high risk for passing the infection on to children in the womb. Now, if it is early detected, it can often stop and not allow residual infection to the child. However, if damage has already been done, it often may not be reversed. One of the cases of death as a result of syphilis was to a child in St. Louis. And what had actually happened is she had been screened. This woman had been screened early in her pregnancy, but then she had gone back to a partner who had reinfected her in her second trimester, and the child was born with syphilis. So a lot of times it can't be reversed if it's not treated early. Antibiotics can prevent the progression, but it doesn't necessarily reverse some of the signs that have happened. Really, the only way to test is blood. Now, I've heard that there's a new test for syphilis that is a quick test. Are you familiar with that? Have you heard? Someone was mentioning that that is something that they're gravitating towards, but they would always follow that up with a secondary test. So typically, it's an RPR. And it is a test, and it just shows reactive or non-reactive. So if it comes back with a reactive, then we actually are having them come back in and doing a second set. And the second set is a TPPA. And that will give us an actual titer to let us know, is this a new infection or is this a latent infection? For treatment of primary, secondary, or early, it is going to be penicillin B. It is like giving someone Elmer's glue. You do have to take it out of the refrigerator and try to warm it up a little bit. it is so painful. I hate giving injections, but I hate most giving this injection because it is so thick, the consistency. But a single dose, if someone is allergic to penicillin, then the doxycycline, 100 milligrams BID for 14 days. The problem is, again, compliance. Is someone going to take that for that amount of time? And then, of course, partner treatment is very important. One of our staff members was discussing with another staff member and made the comment that, oh, yeah, the Domino Brothers are going to be in today, and, hey, Carolyn, can you be around to do treatment? And I'm thinking, Domino Brothers, like, okay, this must be like pizza delivery guys that, you know, have somehow got involved in a ring or whatever. No, turned out it was three men over the age of 50 that got together. Two had lost spouses. They got together to literally play dominoes and then were engaging in anal sex. And so these three men had all come in contact with syphilis, and so they all had to be treated. So kind of a crazy world out there, ladies, but yeah. And it's not just on the male side. Most of our syphilitic cases have been female, but just know, and I can tell you, I have never had a more appreciative group than those three. They were gentlemen, they were kind, they were so appreciative of what we did and how we served, and we had the opportunity to speak Jesus into these three gentlemen and share. But now, a lot of the things I'm sharing, notice I share the most out-of-the-box ones, so it's not like this happens every day. But that is the treatment that you will need. If it is late syphilis, sometimes there will be a three-dose series. So they'll come in, they'll have to get one, they come back, they come in three different times for those that have had the late series. Bacterial vaginosis, we talked about, that is not a sexually transmitted infection. However, it is listed in the MMWR and on the CDC. It's listed under the sexually transmitted infections section. Partly it's because if you aren't having sex, you're less likely to get bacterial vaginosis. They aren't really sure the whole indication, but they do believe that it has to do with you having very healthy flora that is in your vaginal canal. But sometimes if that's disrupted from sexual activity or from, you know, spermicides, from other things that are in the vaginal canal, it can kind of disrupt the normal flora. So this aggressive kind of overgrowth of bacteria has to be kind of taking place in. And one of the things that we see is a lot of times if there is chlamydia or gonorrhea or there's yeast, there can be concurrently the infection of BV at the same time. So, you know, you have to be careful that you are being very cautious in how you counsel, because again, it is not a sexually transmitted infection. There are many monogamous female women who are in relationships with only their husband that have had bacterial vaginosis. So it is not considered a sexually transmitted infection, but we do see it a lot. So again, there is a CLIA waiver test that allows us to do that. But it does seem to just up the chances of you getting other infections. So it's called fishy fanny. I'll just tell you that it stinks. There is a distinct odor that often accompanies. And so people will come in and will say something's not right down there. Or they will say, my partner's complaining when he's down there. And it's this foul odor that they have. So that's something that, you know, just as that bacteria that's emitting that in symptom. A condition in which women normal have bacteria, but in the vagina it's changed and it's replaced by other bacteria. BV is the most common vaginal infection in women of childbearing age. It's also that they often have no symptoms except for a foul odor, and sometimes they have burning with urination. So those are some things to know. You can do it with the vaginal swab, which is, you know, just all you have to do is insert a speculum, take a swab of the secretion, and again, it's almost like running a pregnancy test. You soak it in a very small vial, the Q-tip, you drain it off, you add a little bit of color, and if it pops up that it is a bright blue or green, then you know that it's positive. If it's yellow, you know it's negative. So within 10 minutes, I can let a woman know if she's got bacterial vaginosis. You can do it often off of a liquid pap. It can show up at times, and so sometimes just in a routine pap, that will happen. And then the wet mount slide. So again, you can see the cells that will show that. Metronidazole is the treatment. One of the things that we always give is information on what the side effects. The important thing about metronidazole is to know that if you have any alcohol while you are on this medication, it will make you sicker than a dog. So I will sometimes have clients that go, oh, well, can I wait and take this after the weekend? Because we're going canoeing this weekend. You know, so that is an opportune time to be able to explain that, you know, sometimes alcohol is what got you in this situation. So, you know, maybe this would be a good indication of how you might want to limit that intake and might consider, you know, there's so many interesting ways that you can weave in a spiritual conversation. I find that when I'm doing the blood draw for clients, that's when I recognize tattoos. And that is such a natural end to be able to ask. So tell me the story behind that tattoo that can then lead to, I mean, you've got a captive audience when you're taking somebody's blood. So you get them talking and soon they're spilling their whole life history. But, you know, that's something that also when you're talking and you're giving medication and you're asking about practices and you're saying, you know, how's this working for your lifestyle? You know, you've ended up here with this disease. Are you considering that some changes might happen? So always look for those openings where you can be that gospel whisperer, even in the middle of doing a treatment. Metronidazole gel is a little bit more expensive, so it is a little bit more difficult for clients to get, the same with the clindamycin cream. But the metronidazole, 500 milligrams twice a day for 7 days, and it is on the $4 formulary. So if you have that in your state, it really does not cost that much. They can often go to a Walmart or a Dillon's or something like that and get that medication. And you can either call it in or you can dispense it from your location. We're going to move into now the arena of viral STDs, and we're going to start with genital herpes. This classification of viral is, that's where it really gets to be a nightmare when it comes to counseling. You really cannot let your client go to the place that, oh, I got it from my last partner. I got it from this individual. If they've ever had more than one partner, there is not a way to track it down, because a lot of time the manifestation of a viral can lay dormant, and then with stress or with other indications, pregnancy, some of those things, then the virus can suddenly reappear or can be present. So one of the things to know about herpes is that there are two classifications, herpes 1 and herpes 2. There are multiple ways of testing for that. We'll talk about that in a minute, but basically it goes by herpes pretty much by the whole nation. Occasionally somebody will call it virus volcanoes, crotch craters, and love warts. I have no idea love warts because it's not anything like a wart. But that's just some of the names that it goes by. I do want to mention that oral practices in our nation have now changed the complexity of this disease, where it used to be herpes simplex 1 was just like a cold sore. You know, it was something that was found only on the mouth. And genital herpes was only in the genital area. That is not the case anymore. With the multiple practices, you often will find herpes 2 can be found in the mouth, herpes 1 found in the genital area. And there's a new article that came out in the American Family Physician. It was released June 1st of 2016. You might want to look that up. It was volume 93, number 11, and it reports that HIV-1 is now causing at least 50% of all primary genital infections, genital herpes infections outbreak in the USA. So, you know, I think so many of our young people feel that, oh, it's not really sex if we're doing oral sex, and yet they're the ones that are walking in with a genital outbreak, and it's herpes 1 that is found in the genital area. And I have seen some very, very painful outbreaks in the genital area that when we did testing, it was herpes 1. Now, it doesn't usually like to stay in that area. So when physicians are considering whether or not they're going to do suppression therapy, a lot of times if it's not herpes 2, they won't go ahead and do suppressive therapy. A lot of times that depends on the physician. But that is one of the things to consider when you're looking at the different treatment options. One out of six people, and that's 14 to 49, have genital herpes. One out of five girls, one out of nine guys. Again, that internal vault seems to make it more susceptible to women. transmission, skin to skin. So even if you can't see the infection, because it is a viral, you can shed to another person even if there is not active lesions. It is more likely to be shed to someone else if there is open wounds, or there's open lesions, but it doesn't have to be there. So that's one thing when you're doing the education is to make sure that they understand that, you know, you don't necessarily have to have a cold to pass it on to someone. Herpes is kind of like that. And some people can be very exposed and never have an idea that they have it. The same two people can be infected by the same person, and one will have a raging outbreak and another one will not. I don't know about you, but when I see those commercials that show Valtrex and they're riding a horse or they're rowing a canoe and you've been the one that's seen a raging herpetic outbreak, you're thinking, that is not the image that I see when that girl can barely sit down. She hasn't been able to pee for the day because her urethra is so swollen. And that's another thing. You want to make sure that if you have a case like that, you're referring them to the ER. Because if they cannot urinate and that urine is backing up, they may have to have a catheter. So, symptomatically, you need to know how you have to treat someone that's had a raging case. Unfortunately, this is sometimes those situations where someone finds out that someone's been cheating on them because of an outbreak of herpes that they suddenly have. So there's that whole emotional. I think it is for some reason herpes where I'm never sure of what the reaction is going to be when I go in with a positive. It can be as glib and glad as, oh yeah, well everybody has it, I'm not worried about it, I'm not going to tell anybody. Or it can be so devastating that it's almost like what I could imagine the lepers in Jesus' day, that they feel so defined by the disease that you have to stop and you have to recalibrate and you have to let them know. No matter what's happened, whether you've been victimized, whether or not this is a choice that you had to engage with a sexual partner, a disease should never define your worth. And in God's eyes, you are worth far more than any disease could ever define you. So, you know, again, those spiritual God moments that allow you that opportunity. The blisters will often break, and usually 2 to 4 weeks, they'll heal. An important thing to keep into consideration is that if someone has an outbreak, a lot of times by the time they get to you and get that appointment, you know, an antiviral medication is not going to do a whole lot to suppress it because it's already in that raging. They'll go ahead and put you on an antiviral to help it reduce, but it doesn't always if it's already started. There's something called a prodromal syndrome, and a lot of times if someone has multiple outbreaks, they will actually feel a little kind of a tingle that gives them a sensation of knowing, hey, I think I'm going to have another outbreak. We see a lot of outbreaks during finals week of high school or college, when there's a divorce or when there's a breakup. It seems like when someone's immunity is broken down, that's when it goes rampant. Herpes causes, you know, just, I believe it's triple the opportunity for you to have HIV if you have an active case of herpes. And you can see just the painful lesions. In a woman, it's likely to stay in the underwear zone, but like we said, it can travel. In a male, often the symptoms are on the shaft of the penis. I have seen it in the scrotal area, in just any area where it can be. Herpetic Whitlow, that's not necessarily considered an STI, but anyone who works in healthcare, you know you're a little more at risk for that. And there can be herpes lesions of the eye. Now, I have heard it said that there is some concern that those that are having mutual masturbation or those that, you know, have multiple sex practices, that you can actually, from one location, you can infect your own eye or you can infect other areas if you have active outbreaks. Ocular herpes can lead to blindness, so anytime there's a suspicion, they really are getting you in for ophthalmic treatment. Blood and culture are the two ways to identify whether or not someone has a herpetic outbreak. Culture is a little bit more difficult to ascertain. It's about a 70% accurate rate, whereas the blood draw gives you 100% as far as the actual antibody. The difference is blood usually takes a little bit longer. It's often 6 weeks before the body builds up enough antibodies for it to register as a positive. So if you've had someone that was raped a week ago. They didn't want to go and report it. They haven't, you know, you're not going to mess with any forensic data collection. And then they've come to you and they want to be tested for everything. You often have to let them know that we can test you, we can give you presumptive treatment. But in the case of herpes, you really are going to have to wait 6 weeks before the blood test will let you know if there is enough antibody to show in that particular. And the culture is very painful. The culture, you have to actually get the excrement. You have to kind of almost scrape off the top layer to get some of the serum underneath. But that is how many dermatologists do it. Episodic treatment, you're looking at Valtrex or acyclovir. Acyclovir is much less expensive, but you do have to take it 3 times a day, and you have to take it for 10 days. So that's for the episodic. Whereas the Valtrex, you're taking it twice a day. So it's just whether or not you have a client that can handle that. Acyclovir is on the formulary for a less expensive, whereas Valtrex is more expensive. Suppressive therapy, that's something that needs to be discussed with the physician for ongoing care. That is something that's taken daily or twice daily to keep the viral load down. I know back in the beginning, what we found was a lot of physicians were automatically putting people on suppressive. Now they've kind of backed off of that a bit, because if you aren't having any outbreaks, if you aren't having any suppressive, then you really are just pouring in medication when there are no symptoms. So some are choosing to back off of that and not do the treatment as proactively as they did. But a lot of it has to do with the individual history and how the physician tends to determine that that should be done. HIV, we're really not going to spend a lot of time going into that, partly because there is so much information out there. It's interesting that probably there is a great majority in this room that never remember or were never born before there was a world with no HIV. Some of us very distinctly remember when HIV came on, but now it seems to be something that, you know, is just a very commonly diagnosed. In the USA, these are a couple terminologies, but the package, the bug, or burned. There's a very interesting phenomenon that goes along with some who are in a demographic that it's actually, they're known as bug catchers. And what it is those that have found that socioeconomically, those that have HIV, they're seeing that they're so well cared for by society and taken care of in such a good way, especially among the homeless population, that there are actually individuals that are trying to acquire the disease in an effort to also be housed, taken care of, provided for under so many of our federally funded programs. So there has been very distinct information given that we never give HIV results on a Friday, partially because suicide rates that have been known to concurrently go along with someone who gets a result on a Friday that they've had HIV and would choose to take their lives. So that's kind of an interesting statistic. And I think that was really more a few years ago, whereas now I have actually heard a DIS, a disease infection specialist, say to one of our clients that was HIV positive that the chances of them dying from the complications of diabetes are far more likely than someone dying from the complications of AIDS, because it is seen to be so much more treatable and controlled, not cured, but treatable and controlled. Without proper nutrition, without proper guidance, without proper treatment, there is going to be rapid weight loss. There's going to be a dry cough. You're going to see recurring fever. Obviously, from my perspective of living in Africa for 20 years, we saw many that had HIV, and many in the orphanage that we were working with had mothers that were HIV positive. So, you know, that is something that it is a very real disease, even though sometimes we would not tend to see it as frequently as it used to be. 13,000 cases in the USA were attributed to death because of HIV. Some things to know: 1.2 million live with HIV in the USA. That's an incredible number, but that's because over time, the longevity of those living is there. 13,000 will die of AIDS. Transmission is blood, semen, vaginal secretion, and breast milk. So if a pregnant woman is diagnosed with HIV, they will often make sure that she does not breastfeed in that full first few years, just to make sure that that child is okay, first few months, I should say. 1 in 7 individuals with HIV don't know they're infected. The CDC actually has recommended that anyone who is sexually active get a baseline. So pretty much they've given a directive. If you know someone that's been having sex, you want to make sure that there's that baseline because you don't know. We've had a couple cases where it was a mutually monogamous one-time relationship, and the person tested positive. And they actually had tested positive when they were giving blood, but they didn't know where in their childhood or where that they had been exposed and had to come in to get the treatment or to get the referrals. Symptoms can be at the very onset, almost like a flu. You don't realize that anything's happened, but suddenly you just feel so cruddy. And so the symptoms are often described as at the time of infection coming down with a flu. Other symptoms may take months, years. Now, there's a new second-generation test. Actually, it's a newer fourth-generation that we've just received that we're using that only has 28 days of incubation. It used to be that, you know, you would test someone, you would wait 3 months, you would wait 6 months. But the new fourth-generation allows within 28 days that you know the incubation period. There is no cure yet, but we do have the ability to test through an oral swab, a finger stick, or a blood. Through the oral swab or the finger stick, they're usually going to do the blood to confirm. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind. You may find that it's easy just to do the quick or sure test, but you will need to confirm that perhaps through your own clinic or through someone else to make sure. Treatment regimes do need case management, so that is something that we do refer on. We're going to talk a bit about HPV. Again, this has evolved so much in the last few years in terms of understanding, and it's constantly in the process of being researched and people delving deeper into knowing. And it is very complex because there are so many different strains, and the information can be so complex as to, well, I don't have anything that I can see, so I must not have it. Well, you can't see your cervix. Well, he has them on the outside. How come I have them on the inside? It's just a very, very complex, but it's important to make sure that we are educating. Some people, you know, HPV, warts, Percy. I don't know where Percy came from, but that's what some of the terms are. And it, you know, like I said, it's not just frogs that have the warts. So we know that 79 people currently live and are infected with HPV. There are 40 different strains out of 100 different known strains of the HPV virus that are sexually transmitted. So there's a lot of other strains that are not sexually transmitted. You know, you get a wart on your finger. Well, that's not necessarily a sexually transmitted wart. But 40 of the 100 are transmitted sexually. 90% of HPV infections go away within 2 years. Now, that's some pretty interesting statistics, because it used to be that ACOG, we were papping everyone, and they were finding how many women, how many young girls all had this. They were going in and doing LEAP procedures or colposcopies. They were basically frying so many cervixes, not understanding that most of the time a woman will clear it on her own. But it may take up to 2 years. So currently they are not suggesting that anyone be screened for HPV under the age of 21, because they know that there can be permanent damage done to a cervix through multiple procedures. That doesn't mean that a young girl that is sexually active should not have a pelvic exam, because, again, you can't see what's going on in there. A physician can't tell unless they do a pelvic exam. So we still feel like it's very important as a process for someone who is very sexually active to understand the importance of getting the proper treatment and the gold standard of doing the pelvic exam. We do know that transmission can be direct, genital to genital, skin to skin, anything. It doesn't have to be intercourse in order for there to be that touching. You can have it even transmitted through birth. There have been some severe cases where literally a child was born with, and you probably know the term, but born with warts down through the vocal cords as a result of coming through a vaginal canal and being exposed. Those are very, very rare, but it does happen. It's the same with the hepatic lesions. If a baby is born when a mother has an active case, especially her first active case, she can be born with such severe herpetic infections that it often makes the baby's brain look like cottage cheese, and there's not often a recourse for improvement in that. So many of these diseases, we're talking specifically to the young woman, but they can have effects on the child as well. I have a dentist that is on my board, and he will tell you that they are seeing more and more oral HPV in the throat as a result of practices. So it can be identified in the mouth, and they're all different forms and lesions. They don't always all look the same. This is one that is just in the vaginal opening. You can often just see sort of a condyloma seed bed of where it's beginning. This is an extreme case of genital HPV. The worst case that I ever saw was actually visible on the gentleman through his jeans. And it turned out that he was also positive for syphilis. And so the syphilis and the immunity of that together had caused HPV, and he had not wanted to go anywhere. They actually had to surgically remove the HPV lesions because of how rampant it had been. But it was due to the immune suppressed. It is not a respecter of sites, so it can be anal HPV. It can also be vaginal. One of the more difficult cases that we had was a young girl who came in that did have vaginal HPV lesions. We talked to her about the importance of not having sex. My dermatologist came in and did liquid nitrogen treatment. What we didn't say to her was, so please don't go out and let him do anal sex. The next time she came in, she had anal warts. And it was like at that point in time that we went, no, we cannot be a respecter of only giving partial information. We need to make sure that people understand what is sex and what is not sex and how that can be harmful. This particular young woman had to then be treated with liquid nitrogen, not only in the vaginal area, but also in the anal area because of the practices and the recurrent treatment with a partner that had given her the HPV. Oops, sorry.